Y'all join me in giving Sean a hand.
Hey, good morning. This is a lot of fun. It's always good for me to be back home to Texas. I live in Southern California. I was born in a little, actually, it used to be little, Richardson. It's not so little anymore. And whenever I travel, though, I always know when I'm in Texas. I don't know about you, but if you travel, you're on the road, you wake up and you're in like a hotel, haven't had your coffee yet. But I always know when I'm in Texas because when I go down to get breakfast in the hotel room, it's only in Texas that the waffle machine is shaped like the state. Right? They don't do that in like Rhode Island. That'd be really small waffles. But in Texas, everything is big. Well, look, there. I get a chance to speak at big conferences, small conferences, and everywhere in between. And a conference this size actually gives you a real special advantage. I would encourage you, visit the booths, talk to the folks, talk to the speakers, take advantage of. You've got Steve Lee here from Prestonwood, been doing apologetics for years with students. Talk his ear off. I'm serious. Take advantage of a crowd this size to get to know and ask questions and find out things from the speakers. You've got Jay Watts down here. I mean, it is loaded today. Dr. Zwierink in the back, you'll get to meet him, but take advantage of the speakers and the resources. I think that's something unique we have today. We're going to jump in. I'm going to do something different for us to start. I don't have a fancy slides. I'm actually not even going to give a talk because I brought something with me I affectionately call my atheist glasses. So what that means is when these glasses go on, my worldview is going to transform from Christian professor. I'm actually also a part-time high school teacher at a private school. Christian to atheist. Now I'm going to open it up for whatever questions you'd like to ask, challenges you would like to raise to an atheist. And I'll do my best to respond. And then I'll take the glasses off. We'll debrief it and talk about how this prepares us for the day. You guys ready for this? You're like, I did not sign up for this. Too bad. You're here. Lock the doors. Don't let them out. All right. So let me set this up, though, before we jump in. So I have two mics up here. There was two mics up here. Bo, I think you took one mic for me. We have two mics. And what's going to happen in a minute is I'm going to get two volunteers. Steve's going to help me out with one of them. Jay, will you help me out with the other one? Here's one mic. If he can get that, the other mic is there. There we go. Grab that from him. You guys can have a seat for a minute. I'm going to set this up. Yeah, don't wear yourself out. So here's what's going to happen. When the glasses go on, I'm going to tell the story that's actually a friend of mine who's an atheist. It's only going to take 3-4 minutes. And then we're going to have two mics roam around. You put your hand up. You can ask the atheist anything you'd like to ask an atheist. A question for clarification, a challenge, and I'll do my best to respond. All right? And then we'll go out of character and we'll debrief it at the end. Now, before we start, though, keep a couple things in mind. Number one, if somebody comes in late, please tell them what we are doing. Hopefully this is for obvious reasons, but I teach at Biola in a graduate program in apologetics, and I went to Biola as an undergrad, and one of my most memorable chapels. Imagine like our gym, a college gym, even bigger than this. There's like 2,000 or 3,000 students there. And this fellow was a missionary to Muslims. So he started off by saying, I'm going to give a Muslim evangelistic message. And then I'm going to take questions from the audience. Let's see how well prepared you are to have a thoughtful conversation with a Muslim. It was super interesting. Well, he puts on like this Arabic garb to role play, starts, and this student comes in late, not knowing what's going on. From the back of the gym, in front of the entire student body, he shouts out, this is not the house of Allah. This is the house of the one true living God. Awkward silence. Every time I saw him on campus, it was like, yeah, there goes that guy. So don't be that guy. Don't be that girl. We're just role playing, okay? Second, I'm not saying all atheists believe exactly as I do in character. There's a huge range of beliefs amongst people who would consider themselves atheists. So there's existentialists, there's nihilists, secular humanists, Marxists. There's a fellow online who calls himself the friendly atheist. And I know some people where the last adjective I would use is friendly for being an atheist and everywhere in between. Just like there's variety in attitude and beliefs among Christians. So I'm not saying all atheists believe this. It really just depends on how much sleep I get. And you'll have to find out what that means. All right, so we've got our mics ready to go. Just shoot your hand up. I'll come find you. After I put the glasses on, we start our story. This fellow in the back is ready to go. He is pumped. But we're going into character, and then we're going to start. All right? Here we go. Good morning, church. Thank you for having me at your event. This is an apologetics event. Is that right? I love it when Christians get together and apologize for their faith, given how much damage the Christian faith has done to women, to gays, to society for thousands of years. I appreciate that there's at least some Christians who will own it and say sorry for the damage the Christian faith has done. Well, believe it or not, I used to be a Christian. I went to a Christian church. My family's Christian. I went to conferences. I prayed. I read my Bible. I did all the things I was told to do. I shared my faith to do as a good Christian young man. I believed it. Now when I was about 15, 16 years old, I started having these conversations with a friend of mine. We debate politics, we debate culture, and we debate theology. And she asked me some questions I hadn't really thought about before. My first thought was, well, the Bible says. My second thought was, well, my parents taught me. My third thought was, my pastor said. And then my fourth thought kind of changed everything. My fourth thought was, I really don't know the answer to that. I'm going to find an answer and follow truth wherever it leads. Well, to make a long story short, when I began to actually investigate the evidence, I realized that there's no scientific evidence to think that God exists. There's no reason to think the Bible's true. I mean, historically, there's too many errors and mistakes and contradictions, let alone the immoral teachings of the Bible like slavery, misogyny, and genocide to come from a holy God. And frankly, I'm not even sure that I really believe Jesus existed. I think it's better explained as patterned after these dying rising gods of the ancient Near East. There's nothing unique about the Christian story. I became an atheist. It was tough at first because my community was unsettled and I could see the looks on people's faces like they thought I was going to hell. But over time, it was actually freeing for me to just follow and embrace truth wherever it leads. So I guess I look at it like this and then we'll take some questions. How many of you remember the stories from English or history class, like the ancient Greco-Roman gods? Do you know these stories? Poseidon and Zeus and Hades. You remember these kind of stories? Okay, good. So when the ancient Greeks couldn't explain something like, say, earthquakes, what did they say was the cause? The gods are angry. Or they couldn't explain rain, they said what? The gods are crying? No, gods don't cry. The goddesses were crying. Which would include Thor, by the way. Now, you're laughing, but in the comic books, Thor's not a person. It's actually whoever wields the Thor, the hammer, it's a title. And in the comic books, it's wielded by a woman. How many of you knew that? Put your hands up. Okay, put them up high. Okay, look around at all the nerds. Stepped right into that, didn't you? See, the ancient Greeks couldn't explain why the ground was moving or water was falling out of the sky. So what did they do? They said, oh, it must be the gods are angry. The gods must be crying. This is called God of the Gaps. When you don't have a scientific or a natural explanation, you insert God into the lack of our knowledge. Well, there's a problem with this. If you put God in the gaps, what happens as science advances? The gaps get smaller and smaller and smaller. Now, if you want to believe in God because it gives you purpose, that's fine. If you want to believe in God because of blind faith and it helps you have community, I have no problem with that. But my problem is when someone says they think it's objectively true as if there's evidence for it. That's where I would say time out. And by the way, if you could convince me Christianity's true, I would believe it. I mean, if you actually had good evidence for it, I'd believe. The reality for me is there's just no good evidence. And there is good reason to think that atheism is true. Well, I could keep talking, but I think we'll have a much more interesting exchange if we just open it up. So if you guys will spread out for me, shoot your hand up, what question would you have for an atheist? and I'll do my best to respond.
Are you absolutely sure that truth is relative?
Okay, so let me take a step back. Did I say that truth was relative?
Yes.
I did?
Yes.
When did I say that?
You said that other people's truths are for them and you have your own.
I never said that.
So you
never said that.
You believe in an absolute truth.
So let me just clarify. I never said truth is relative. I never said I'm absolutely certain. Those are different things. Now, he can follow up if we want to. I think there's such a thing as truth. I think truth exists outside of us. I just don't think God is truth. I don't think we need a God to understand or explain the world we live in. That's it. By the way, I don't think you believe in absolute truth. Are you a Christian, by the way? You can hand it to me. I don't think you believe in absolute moral truth either, by the way. Do you?
Yes.
So, like, lying is wrong?
Yes.
What about Rahab? She lied. What about the midwives in Exodus?
Uh-huh.
They lied. They deceived the people, didn't tell the truth, broke the ninth commandment. So you don't really believe in absolute truth either, do you?
I do.
But you just said lying is wrong, but it's not wrong. So lying is wrong when it's not? Do you work
it's
for
wrong.
The Trump administration?
It is definitely wrong, and we all lie.
So why was Rahab in the Hall of Faith if it's wrong?
Well, because we all fall short.
Yeah, but she's held up as a model of faith.
So was Samson. Have you seen his rap sheet?
Yeah, but the question is, Samson was held up because of his act of dying at the end, sacrificing his life. Rahab was held up for lying.
We're held up by grace alone. That's our belief.
That's a part of her story, though. So, all right, interesting. Good questions. Yes.
You said there's no scientific evidence for God. Would you say that science is properly suited to address theology? That is, it overlaps with theology and faith issues of, as you understand theology to be?
Oh, I don't think it does. In principle, it could, but there's actually no scientific evidence that points towards God.
So to clarify, there's no scientific evidence that points against or away from God either because it's not. Science isn't theology, correct?
Of course, science isn't theology.
Okay.
But I think we can look at the natural world and see very good reason to believe that a God is not involved.
So does science address supernature or does science address nature?
Science is the attempt to find a naturalistic understanding of the world in which we live.
Okay. So science doesn't speak. It's an argument from silence, then. To say that science.
That's not an argument from silence.
God, or to say there is a God.
That's not an argument from science. Silence. That's what science does.
So would you say scientific evidence informs, say, philosophy as you draw conclusions about whether or not there's a God? Because science wouldn't be addressing whether a supernatural being exists because it's not addressing supernature. It's addressing nature and explaining nature, correct?
Does science inform philosophy? Is that what you said?
Yeah.
No, you can't do science without philosophy.
Okay.
It's impossible to do so.
So you would say then that science must inform philosophy before a person via science can draw a conclusion about whether or not...
No, I would say philosophy informs science, not science informs philosophy.
So
you can't do science without certain philosophical assumptions.
So you're saying science is theological because it addresses supernature.
Science is the attempt for naturalistic explanations. That's what science does. Now,
okay.
If there was evidence for a supernatural world in principle, then science could address it. The reality is there's just not. There's not a shred of evidence for anything supernatural.
So science isn't restricted to natural causes.
I feel like we're talking in a circle.
Causes.
Did you have a question about the evidence?
The question was that if you're talking about evidence within the framework of nature, then you're not talking about evidence or things that are strictly supernature. You're addressing one realm and then drawing inferences.
Well, that depends on how we define what nature is. What is nature? Is nature all that exists? You think a soul exists? Is that a part of nature? I don't think there's any evidence for a soul. If there was a soul, in principle, it could be identified scientifically. But it's not identified because there's no evidence for such a thing as a soul.
If there were a supernature, it would be discernible by natural science.
Could be. Why couldn't it? There's a God who talks. if there's a God who does supernatural things?
So if there was a supernature, it would not be supernature. It would be nature. Is that what you're saying?
That's going to depend on how we define nature.
Okay.
What do we mean by nature? So, anybody else? In the back. You guys can spread out for me, Steve. Find questions to the next one. Sneak over here, if you don't mind, to these folks right over here. That fell in the back with a hat. Do we have three mics now? Oh, we're just definitely spreading out. Go ahead. Oh, over there.
What is the difference between you and the slab of concrete?
Me and the slab? I feel like this is a trick question. Well, you walk on the slab of concrete. I would appreciate if you didn't walk on me. I can talk. Last I checked, the slab of concrete cannot talk. There's a lot of things I can do, reasoning, thinking, as a more complex being than concrete that would separate me. Do you disagree, or what's your point?
That slab of concrete can do nothing, and you can do a lot of things. That slab of concrete can't think. It has no emotions. You have emotions. That slab of concrete is made out of precisely the same thing you are. Electrons, protons, neutrons, and 100% virtually empty space. That slab of concrete's made that way. You are too. What's the difference? How is it that you have all this stuff that the concrete doesn't have, but you're made just like the slab of concrete?
Well, it's like anything else. The chair is different than the concrete. This building's different than the concrete. This light, it has certain features and properties made of the same ultimate fundamental particles, but it has different properties because of its constitution. Same with water. Water has wetness, concrete doesn't. These are properties that it has because of its organization that make it different from the concrete. Just look around the world. Everything's not concrete. That's the beauty of some of the diversity we see in nature. Matter is amazing.
But you haven't explained why you're different from a slab of concrete.
Well, you didn't ask why. You asked if I was different than the concrete.
You have described the differences, but you have not described why there's a difference.
That's because you didn't ask me for why. So you can't criticize me for not answering a question that you didn't ask.
I apologize.
Right? I mean, that's only fair. Are you with me?
I apologize for that. Why is there a difference?
This is the beauty of evolution. Concrete is not alive. It's not a part of the biological process of evolution. I am, and by the way, so are you. So is everything else that's alive within the natural world. So living systems, non-living systems. That's the difference.
Well, tell me, what is proof?
What is proof?
Proof.
You guys are asking like these meta questions like, what is science? What is proof? Well, proof looks different in history than it does in, say, psychology, from how it does in biology and physics. So when it comes to biology, I wouldn't use the term prove. I think maybe people use that in certain investigations. But the evidence for biological evolution is overwhelming. There is no question about it. I mean, how many of you don't – okay, let me just – so I understand. How many of you don't believe in Darwin's theory of evolution? Let me see your hands. You don't believe in Darwin and evolution. Okay. All right. Put your hands down. How many of you put your hands up if you can give me an actual definition of neo-Darwinian evolution? Put your hands up. I'm going to call on you. Just a definition. Okay, wait a minute. So none of you believe in it. Maybe five or six of you can define it. And I'm the one who's on trial to give definitions for terms like proof. Don't you think you need to understand what Darwinian evolution is, which answers your question, before critiquing me for holding it? I mean, the evidence for evolution is overwhelming. Have you read Jerry Coyne's book, Why Evolution is True? Or Richard Dawkins' book, The Greatest Show on Earth? I mean, it's overwhelming. The evidence for evolution, it's game over. Just like Cleveland in the Eastern Conference, game over. Spurs Rockets, game over. Spurs, by the way. Does that answer your question?
No. You'll have to pardon me. I have hearing aids, and I'm not hearing all of the words you're saying, okay?
Thank God for science that gave you hearing aids.
I don't even know the definition of some of them. I heard one word there. I don't even know what it is. So. But anyway, the bottom line of where I am is proof is altogether totally personal. Proof resides in the mind of the perceiver. Whatever he accepts by faith becomes proof to him.
So if proof is in the mind of the person who believes things, how do you judge the 9/11 terrorists? In their minds, what they did was justified. And they would say they have faith. This is why I don't accept the kind of faith and proof you're talking about. It leads to danger, leads to harming other people, because it's true for me. God spoke to me. This is where science says it's not in my mind, it's in the world. We observe evidence, we make arguments, and then we examine those. That's why we see religion causing such bloodshed, but not science. Good questions. Let's go over here.
So what do you think is the best way to account for the resurrection appearances?
Oh, I don't think Jesus appeared to anybody. I think they're stories that were made up.
So at what point in time do you think they were made up?
Well, there's different resurrection stories. I mean, we know all the accounts are pretty late and not really reliable. There's contradictory accounts between them. Even between Paul and the historical Jesus, on basic stuff, there's contradiction.
So that brings up a good point on Paul. So Paul, in 1 Corinthians, quotes a creed that goes back, well, first of all, he wrote 1 Corinthians around AD 55.
How do you know that, by the way?
Well, that's the historians. That's what the historians say.
The historians say. Now you're making generalizations about the historians. Which ones?
Yeah, we are making generalizations.
Conservative.
About
Actually, Republican historians?
All historians. Atheist historians date it to the mid-50s. So I usually trust atheist historians on the dating of 1 Corinthians.
So you trust atheist historians dating 1 Corinthians, but not when it comes to evolution?
I don't.
So you're selective on those that you accept.
I don't trust any historians on evolution, by the way.
Atheist scientists you would trust, whatever discipline it would be.
So I think we're going in circles here. So to go back to the 1 Corinthians, so Paul quotes a creed that says that Jesus was died and buried and resurrected and appeared to a whole slew of people. And this was written around in mid-AD 50s by virtually all historians, skeptical otherwise, and virtually all of them, including folks like James Tabor or Bart Ehrman, date the creed going all the way back to the early 40s at the very latest, and more likely the late 30s. So there you have something that doesn't seem to account for the time. There's no time for a legend develop. It's only a few years. So, and you have these resurrection appearances, and we do have evidence that quite a few of them, that all of them were willing to die for their faith, and quite a few of them did die for their faith.
Is that a question? That sounds like a mini speech that you snuck in there. So I'll respond to your mini speech. So Bart Ehrman, James Tabor, atheists or at least agnostics, recognize the validity of this creed, therefore the appearances are true, Jesus rose from the grave. A few problems. Number one, James Tabor and Bart Ehrman do not believe Jesus rose from the grave. So even if you concede this creed, you still don't get to the resurrection by the very atheist scholars that you're citing. Second, if you compare 1 Corinthians 15, 3 through 7, this creed, it says Jesus appeared to Peter, to the 12, to the apostles, to James, to the 500. Who do the Gospels say Jesus appeared to first?
Peter.
No, who do the Gospels say Jesus appeared
to? Peter among the first.
The women, thank you. So Paul doesn't even mention the women. He's probably not aware of it. The Gospels mention the women. In fact, the first gospel, Mark, doesn't even have the appearances. It doesn't even list the appearances. And then 1 Corinthians 15 says he appeared to the 500, right? Where? Give me one name of one of the 500. Look, if you start to analyze this, it starts to crumble from within. So I don't even know I would concede the dating. I don't know that I would concede it was a creed. But even if it is, you still have people like Ehrman, Tabor that don't buy it. And you still have contradictions with the gospel, which tells me this is unreliable reporting.
Well, not listing women is not a contradiction. It's a lack of listing all people.
It's a lot. It's a lack of careful historical analysis. Or it's an agenda driven. And that's what the Gospels are. They're biased. What does Jesus say? I'm writing this so that you may believe. He's no different than CNN. He's got a bias, and he's going to leave out evidence that doesn't fit his bias. It's fake news. Good question. Let's go to somebody else. Get your questions as soon as you can. Go ahead.
Good morning, Mr. McDowell. I want to start by saying I think you'd make a great Christian. with your sense of morals and your sense of truth and your outrage at what religion has caused on the world, and your sense of just how you don't like the slavery in the Bible and the things like that, what I would ask you is, by what standard do you sit up there and project a standard on everyone else of what morality should be? If we live in a world where there's no God, meaning if a Christian wants to go out and say that slavery is okay or things like that, by what standard can you sit up there and quote other authors and who pull their intellect from who knows what, a rock that's floating out in outer space that exploded? By what standard can you sit over there and condemn religion but not condemn the same people that have come from an atheist background or any background who have murdered, lied, cheated, and steal? If you have a problem with...
I have no problem condemning atheists who've done wrong things.
But that's not what you opened up with. You opened up with against religion.
Well, you guys are like critiquing me for things I didn't even say. This is I'm noticing a pattern here, like blaming me for things I didn't have a chance to comment on. Sure, some atheists have done bad things. It pales in comparison the amount of bad things done in the name of religion. And there's something about religion itself that incites violence towards other people and bigotry and intolerance. That's my problem with the religion. Have there been some atheists who've done bad things? Sure, I'll happily concede that. I got no problem with it.
But what I'm specifically asking outside of that, and by the way, I'm not sitting back here saying we're going in circles and I'm accusing you of something you didn't say. Your opening speech that you gave.
I know, but I can't say everything in a speech.
About the slavery and all that. What I'm asking you is, by what standard can you tell somebody that something's wrong in a world where there's no conscience, that if someone has a conscience or they don't, it doesn't matter because you can't explain where
okay,
it comes from.
Okay, so let me stop you right there. You're putting words into my mouth. Like he said, I'm a relativist, don't believe in absolute truth. I never said that. I never said people don't have a conscience. I think we have a conscience. That's how we know right from wrong.
Well,
Christians
what I'm saying is
have a conscience. Atheists have a conscience. Now, you'd probably say that conscience was given to you by God, hence Romans chapter 2. I think we have a conscience. That's how we know right and wrong. But we don't need a God to tell us certain things are right and wrong. It's obvious upon reflection. It's been wired into us by evolution.
Right. But well, I'm not.
Oh, so you are a skeptic.
The debate on conscience, no, I'm a skeptic of you and what you say truth is. Because I don't think you can give me a definition or a truth standard. I don't think you have any more standard than the guy walking down the street or anyone out there. You might be intellectual about it, but you cannot hold
so
anyone
here,
to a certain
here's,
standard.
Here's what truth is. Truth is when a belief matches up with reality. That's it.
Based on what?
Just stop and think about it. When you say based on what, you're asking for some evidence to show that a certain view is true. You can't communicate without the corresponding theory of truth. We don't debate about what truth is.
So
you and I agree. So let me explain. Take a deep breath. You and I agree that this building is here. We look up, we make a claim, this building is here, and since it's actually here, that belief is true. If you said, no, this building's not here, we're in a cornfield in Iowa, that claim would be false. That's all truth is. So you make a statement, morality comes from the Bible. Well, if we look at the Bible, we see genocide. We see slavery. We see women told to wear hats and not speak in church, which I notice none of you ladies here are actually following, which tells me you pick and choose which parts of the Bible that you want. I don't blame you. If I was a Christian, I would do that too. So I don't use the Bible as a standard for morality. I actually think Sam Harris is correct in his book, The Moral Landscape, that science can help adjudicate which behavior is good and which behavior is not good. We can look at the effects of it. We can look at the results objectively. It's a standard outside of us. We don't make it up. I believe in a real right and wrong. Why would we need God when we have conscience and we have science to help adjudicate what is good and what is not good behavior? Why bring God, especially with all the baggage that the Bible brings? would be my question.
Yeah, well, I agree with you there, but what I'm saying is somebody created this building, somebody built this building, and that's also a truth.
So, I agree with that 100%.
So if I have that truth and I can look at it, because you say there's no scientific evidence
for God.
You say there's no historical evidence.
There's not.
But that's all subjective based on your truth.
That's not subjective. Give me some scientific or historical evidence.
Well, you listed a lot of atheist offers, a lot of scientists that are atheist in their worldview that have your same beliefs. What I'm challenging you to, if you're going to take verses out of context, out of the Old Testament, I think you should understand the Old Testament of why the women in here aren't dressing the way they should be before you give a comment on the Bible as if you're a theologian and an expert.
So just for the record, that's in the New Testament, not the Old Testament. Right?
New Testament.
So you're going to tell me I should understand the Bible? It goes both ways.
Well, in a world where there's no God, I can make mistakes. So I'm saying New Testament, Old Testament. I'm saying you're sitting up there as if I weren't a doctor, I wouldn't go in and perform surgery on somebody. I think you're an intellectual atheist, but I don't think you're one of the greatest theologians, and therefore I don't think you're qualified enough, or you, by your own words, that you understand the Bible well enough to critique.
Did I say I was the greatest theologian? I don't remember saying this.
Well, you don't have to say
I've
it.
I've never made these calls. I just want some answers for the questions. I just want some evidence. That's it.
That's what
now
I
you've
want.
Asked like 30 questions. Let's give someone else a chance. In the back.
Roll Tide.
You had brought up the topic of evolution a number of times. So I would define evolution as an undirected process of natural selection acting on random variation.
Good job.
And it takes a long time and slowly, bit by bit, the species are developed, and eventually you'll get different genre. So my question for you is the part about the random variation. There's a lot of development of information from the very earliest cell to no cell, and there's a lot of information from a very earliest cell to a human being. Where did that information come from?
Have you read Richard Dawkins' book, Climbing Mount Improbable?
Yes. Well, I don't know that book, but I do know his Methinks It's Like a Weasel.
That was from The Blind Watchmaker. That was 1986. He wrote Climbing Mount Improbable in the mid to late 90s. And actually walks through, he says, when you look at a mountain, you think, oh my goodness, it's impossible. But if you go around the back in a very step-by-step manner, you get increased complexity and diversity over time. You can make it up the mountain through the back trail. So you're right, if you look at no life, cell, human being, that's an impossible jump. But through the slight process of random variation, like you said, random selection acting on, natural selection acting on random variation in a step-by-step manner, you can get the information that we have today. And by the way, I don't even know that I'd use the term information. It's just kind of a word we use, but it's not really information. It's just matter in different states.
Well, actually, information is a mathematical term for the inverse of probability. And more specifically, specified information is not just a Shannon information, but an information that has a purpose as opposed to just an improbable circumstance. And so in respect to that mountain that you see over there that you want to climb in his whatever book that was, Improbable.
Climbing Mount Improbable.
You look around and you see which mountain first you want to climb. Then you walk around to the back side and see this little step by step. So you already know what mountain you're trying to climb. That's not an undirected process. You have to be blind and not know where the mountains are. You might climb one that's only 2 feet high, and then you're at the top, and you don't know to climb down because you don't. You're already at the maximum. So that's not a good representative of what evolution really is. That's not a good model.
I think what's Dawkins' point? Dawkins' point is that you can get increased complexity and diversity through a step-by-step, simplistic process over time. And we actually see that in nature. You can see that with the eye. If you look at nature today, we have the simplest kind of eyes all the way up to complex like octopus or, say, human eyes. And every single step along the way, we see increased receptors. We see more complex retinas. So it's not like there's one thing the way you described it, the beginning, and then you have a cell. We actually have every single step along the way and beyond to the eye. That's the point that Dawkins is making. And when we look in nature, we see that. And we actually see evolution tinkering with things like the eye before us in the present. And the fossil record corroborates it. So that's the point that Dawkins is making that he spells out in the book, I think, pretty well.
So let's start with that eye, that really simple patch of light-sensitive cells. You have to have, for that light patch of light-sensitive cells to be have a selective advantage for them, for it to occur to begin with, you already have to have a signaling system from that patch of light-sensitive cells to a some sort of a response so that it's useful for that organism. Say, Chlamydomonas that has a very simple eye spot. And so you already have to have a lot of systems set up. Now, so just how much increase in, I have to use the word information, which is a gathering of proteins or things that
No, I got it. You're losing folks. I can see it. Get to your point very quickly.
Well, I was going to ask you, but I can just, the point would be just that real simple patch of light-sensitive cells that everyone assumes is there is a pretty high mountain to climb when you look at the probabilities of that occurring by chance. So the random variation is a pretty, pretty high, steep mountain.
So let me jump in. Here's why you need to read Dawkins' book. It's not by chance alone. He is very clear to lay out that this is not a chance random process. It's not a purposeless random process in the way that we talk about purpose. Now, random variation is the mechanism that natural selection operates on, but there's nothing random about this. There's law-like features, and there's natural selection operating towards the favorability of an organism. So even the slightest change towards the minimal kind of eye would favor an organism to survive above those that don't. That's his point. Check out his book. Let's go to the next question.
I've got a follow-up question. When you talk about the lowest level organisms and get down to the protein level, you reach a point of irreducible complexity. Do you believe in that?
Wait, like Michael Behe's irreducible complexity?
Yes.
No, I don't believe. Do you?
Yes.
That's been because almost universally rejected.
Because there's certain, when you get down to protein level, they cannot operate without having millions of components coming together at once. They can't evolve to that point.
So Michael Behe didn't use the example of proteins. He used like the flagellum, for example, when he talked about, how many of you know what irreducible complexity is? How many of you say, I have no idea what you're talking about? I say, I'm not voting on anything after this election season. I'm finished for good. Okay, all right. Bottom line, Kenneth Miller has written an article called The Flagellum Unspun in a 2004 Oxford University Press volume called Debating Design. It actually shows in a step-by-step manner how you can get from this, like building the mousetrap, so to speak, how you could get a more complex mousetrap and how this applies to the flagellum. Things like the TTSS precursor system, that has about 10 of the parts of the flagellum, it still functions as a simpler system. In fact, it pumps in bacteria from the environment into certain cells and actually kills them. So he shows there's a simpler system with some of the parts that functions and others along the way, which is why the scientific community has essentially near universally rejected irreducible complexity. I would check it out. We have time for maybe one or two more.
Hi, Sean. I'm Ken. I am a fan of science, just like you are. A scientific rule says every action has an equal and opposite reaction. Do you believe that's true?
Which rule is that?
I don't know, but it's in there.
Okay, if you're a fan of science,
every action,
you should probably know.
Every action has an equal and opposite reaction.
So these are some of Newton's claims. This is true on a macro level.
Macro, yeah.
Okay. Well, you can't just throw out macro because that completely breaks down on the quantum level.
Okay.
So as a result of
this law, something can't come out of nothing. So how do you explain the start of the universe?
Okay, so what you're talking about is true, on a macro level before we learned about quantum mechanics.
Okay.
All of the cause and effect you're talking about completely breaks down.
Okay, there's, so how do you not explain the start of the universe?
Well, that has nothing to do with the principle that you just brought into mind. Now, you might be thinking of the first law of thermodynamics that says matter's neither created or destroyed.
Right.
Right.
But still, what's your view on how the universe got started?
So here's what we know. First law of thermodynamics, matter's neither created nor destroyed. I don't believe matter was created, because if matter was created, what does that imply? There's a creator.
A creator. Right.
So it's actually the idea that there's a creator that violates the most fundamental law we know about first law of thermodynamics.
Where did matter come from?
Okay, I'll get there. I'm just explaining why the theological answer doesn't work. The other reason it doesn't work to say God created is because you're left with the problem, who made God? If you say God made the universe, then you have the problem, who made God? If you say God caused the universe, you're left with the problem, what caused God? And that's back at the beginning, saying, well, the earthquakes are caused by God, which stops scientific pursuit. That's why God doesn't have a place in science, to go back to your question. Now, with that said, I think the universe came from nothing.
So that violates the scientific principles.
It doesn't violate
the scientific
principles.
Okay, so name one other thing that came from nothing.
Okay, we see all the time on the quantum level, matter coming into existence uncaused. We see that happening. Regularly. This is a part of
matter coming from
quantum mechanics. It does. Now look, here's the thing. I realize this hits you as counterintuitive. One of the things that helps me is that when I realize that the world is stranger than fiction. So for example, this seems solid all the way through, right? Right? Are you with me? What percentage of this is actually empty space? Almost all of it. This is almost, now you'd say, that's not counterintuitive. That makes no sense. That can happen. I say, okay, take a step back. Sometimes our intuitive notions don't match up with the way the world is. This is almost entirely empty space. What do people think about the sun going around the earth? I can see the sun rising and I can see it setting. It's obvious. But when science weighs in, what happens? We go, no, it's actually, we are moving around the sun. So one of the things Einstein discovered is space and time actually curves and bends. Well, space does. Light does. It bends. It's deeply counterintuitive, but that's the way the world is. We see matter come into existence uncaused, so why would we have to say God did it?
How do you know it's uncaused? We just recently got into quantum physics, so we obviously are pretty ignorant at this stage. How do you know it's uncaused?
So we've had decades into quantum mechanics. We see uncaused things happening right before us.
Right.
Now, here's what you can do.
And for hundreds of years, we thought the Earth was flat, so a couple decades is nothing.
Actually, we never thought the Earth was flat. This is a myth.
What?
Read the pre-Socratic Greeks. It's a myth that people thought the Earth was flat. Columbus never thought he was going to fall off the Earth. People know it's round. You know how you look at the ocean, if you have a big enough view, you can see it curve like this. They would see boats go out, and you could see going down from it, its sail when it went far enough out, because the Earth actually curves. Look at our reflection on the moon. So people never actually believe it. These are the kind of myths that, as a Christian, I just believe this stuff. Mm-hmm. But then when I started to probe into it, I realized that there's no reason to take Christian worldview seriously.
You're still stuck.
Thank you for your question.
All right.
Good try. Atheist is gone. Atheist is gone. He's out of here. All right. How many of you are like, this is not what I signed up for. I'm not sure about this. Actually, that was really fun. Oh, thank you, Jay. Good job. Nice work. All right, so I got a question for you. Hopefully you're appropriately frustrated right now, riled up a little bit. Let me say one thing before we go any deeper. I don't believe almost anything that I said with my glasses on, okay? So in case you're sitting there going, didn't quite think of that. How would I answer that one? Was that true? I don't believe almost any of it. By the way, some of it I made up. Some of it I gave the standard arguments that I hear. You notice sometimes I just change the subject. Sometimes I use big words. There were a lot of tactics I used and approaches, but I want to make sure you realize that I don't believe almost anything with my glasses on, because I don't want any of you to become an atheist, especially at an apologetics conference. I would never get invited back. That's for sure. All right? Now, one of the reasons I can do this is you have a chance to go say, wait a minute, quantum mechanics, Dr. Zwiering, talk to me about this. He was in the back just chuckling, dying, wanting a mic back there. You can ask him about that. Historical Jesus, talk to me. Talk to some of the other experts. But before we go and answer just a few of these and set you to the breakouts for the day, here's a question to think about. How do you think as a whole you treated your atheist guest? I'm just curious. Individual words. Hostile, that's a strong word. Okay. How about the rest of you? Antagonistic? Okay. What else? Ineffective? Okay. Snarky? I just like that word. That's a good word. Snarky, he said. Okay. We're trying to win an argument as opposed to introduce somebody to Christ. Is that what you said? Okay. All right. Anybody else? Ooh, you thought they were dishonest questions trying to trap me and lead me. That was your, okay. All right. Says Hillary, she's the mama bear apologist, so I don't mess with her. That doesn't answer the question of how I treated you. Okay, so strategically, you felt like you said instead of attacking me, you felt like they were attacking me, watching us from the back. And by the way, Mark heads up an apologetic group here at the church. He was like in the back going, pacing back. He's like, oh my gosh. So he was wanting the mic. If you want to study apologetics after this conference, come to his classes at 8 o'clock and they go through this step by step in a pretty awesome way. And he told me you get a good parking spot if you come at 8. A few weeks ago, I was doing this with a group of students, probably about this size, and I asked the question, and typical answers, I'll typically hear hostile, antagonistic. These are some of the same responses people will give. This girl, she says, insignificant. I said, that's interesting. I've never heard that. What do you mean? She said, it felt like from our group, we were more interested in proving you wrong, making our arguments sound right than really listening and understanding who you were, what you believed. She said, I thought as a person we treated you as if you were insignificant. And that kind of stuck with me. Look, I've done this a lot. Small groups, youth groups of 12. I did it in a stadium of 6,000 students in Minnesota. And actually, this is a group of students. And at that time, I was wearing a hat for my atheist role play. I turned around to start it, and this group of students go, boo, boo, go home, Mr. Atheist. And a youth pastor shouts out, you're going to hell. Like, he just shouts it out. So that caught me off guard. I didn't expect that. So what I did is I said, well, wait a minute. Didn't the Jesus you believe in, wasn't he a friend of sinners? Didn't he say, love your enemies? Didn't Paul in 1 Corinthians 13 talk about if you don't have love, you're like a clanging cymbal, you have nothing? I mean, I laid into these students. It was silent in the whole stadium, which proves there's a God because junior hires were present. The next summer I was speaking at a group in Salt Lake City. I turned around to start, and this group of students sitting right in the front, they go, woo, we love you, Mr. Atheist. And I was like, okay. So I went to them afterwards. I said, why do you start that way? They said, well, we were part of the group that booed you in Minnesota. And I thought, they got the point. They got the point. You see, I studied communications as an undergrad, and we would talk about two general categories. There's the truth or content of what you believe, and then there's the medium by which you communicate it. What's interesting is Jesus came in grace, the relationship, and he came in truth, the content. Today we see people shouting truth from the rooftops. I don't care if it hurts anybody. I'm right, you're wrong, truth, truth, truth. Then we see people who feel like the loving thing to do is to compromise truth. As Christians, neither option is a good option for us. We have to speak truth, but in the right way, at the right time, with a loving attitude towards people. So my question is, what was going on in your heart when I was doing this? Yes, I'm role-playing. Yes, it's early Saturday morning. What was going on in your heart when I was pressing you like this? I did this in your wonderful state. Years ago, I was at a youth camp. And I taught the entire week, like 7 days, probably 10 or 12 plus times. And I started doing my atheist role play. And these students were like as snarky, to use your word, and defensive as any group I remember. And this girl in kind of the middle back left stands up and she goes, "Mister, I just want to read you something." I said, "Okay, what are you going to read me?" She said, "It's from the Bible, the Holy Word of God." I said, "You know, I'm an atheist. I don't believe in the Bible." She goes, "I don't care. Listen up." I was like, "Okay." She reads to me Psalms 14:1. "The fool says in his heart, there is no God." I said, "So publicly you're calling me a fool?" She goes, "Yep, mister, you're a fool." Sits down. Her friends go, "Woo-hoo-hoo, got you." And they're like pointing at me. Well, when it was done, because I stirred up the students, they surrounded me and they were talking for an hour plus until finally all the students were gone. This girl who was going to be a junior, I think she must have been about 16 years old. She said, "I want to thank you for doing your best to defend atheism." I said, "Sure, why are you thanking me?" She goes, "Well, I'm an atheist. This is at a Christian camp." I said, "That's great that you're here. How'd you end up here?" She said, "Well, I am a leader in my youth group." I said, "I feel like I'm missing something." She said, "I grew up in a Christian home. I've gone to church my whole life. I'm in my youth group, and not too long ago, I started having some real questions about God, about the Bible, about other religions. My pastor, my youth pastor, my parents couldn't answer them. They said, 'Don't doubt, just believe.'" She said, "I started to realize I don't even believe anymore." I said, "Well, have you told anyone?" She said, "No, you're the first person." I said, "Why haven't you told anyone?" She said, "Because I'm afraid they'll treat me like they just treated you." I'll never forget that. I don't think as Christians we realize the stories we tell, the words we use, the jokes we laugh at communicate sometimes more through the medium than what we even believe is true. Now, don't mishear me. The gospel is offensive. We cannot compromise the offense of the gospel. But let's not add anything to it that's not intrinsic to the gospel itself. Let's lovingly speak it because we love people rather than simply to win arguments. Can you imagine? Now you're here for this day. You get to hear from some phenomenal communicators, great topics. Can you imagine being a college student, hearing this kind of stuff class after class, week after week, semester after semester, year after year? Now, there are more atheists and agnostics in the university. They're not all with this approach. That's not my point. But my students tell me they get some teachers like this. What I think is more dangerous in the university is not the guy in God's Not Dead, but the professor who just dismisses Christianity as if it's not even worth talking about. That subtle dismissal is powerful in our students. That's why, especially a student away from home where there's moral temptation, they want to fit in, they're lonely, they're tired, they're probably not eating well. If they're not trained and have good reasons, a ton of them are going to walk away. That's why apologetics is so important. Now, just so you can take a deep breath, I've done this in a lot of groups. You guys were not as snarky and hostile and argumentative as you think. Dave Bonner for Works with My Dad and I is here. You've seen me with groups that go far beyond this. You guys, as a whole, we're on probably the nicer spectrum of things, so don't beat yourself up. But it's worth pausing and reflecting and asking, what was going on in my heart when I was doing this? Now, I wrote a book called Is God Just a Human Invention? Responding to the 17 biggest arguments atheists make. So can you have morality without God? Where did the universe come from? Questions about evolution, we have a chapter in there. Is the God of the Old Testament genocide and slavery and women? All the things that we brought up, I wrote in there. When I wrote it, I called it the largest atheist organization, free-thinking group in Southern California where I live. I said, "Hey, my name's Sean McDowell. I've written this book. I'd be happy to come to your skeptical meeting, sit on the hot seat, bring a free copy of the book for anybody who's there, and just try to answer questions that any of you atheist agnostics have about God for a couple hours." Now, I don't know about you, but that actually sounds like fun to me. It's not because I think I have all the answers. I'm well aware that I don't. So I went up to this home. There's about 20 of us. It's my wife, my pastor, and I. And we went in this home. What was interesting is this was an atheist group, so it wasn't a church, but they had coffee and donuts. They had announcements. They actually passed around a hat to take an offering, and I didn't say anything. I'm like, this is not a church. Okay. They were warm, welcoming me in. I sat on the hot seat for a couple hours, and they were firing questions at me. And then at the end, I said, could I ask you some questions? And to tell you, the most interesting of that 2 hours, a guy turned to me, looks at me, goes, no way. And I'm like, no way what? What are you talking about? He goes, you actually have a sense of humor. He was stunned. Why? Because in their world and their experience, Christians are like, well, you remember Angela on The Office? Stuck up, self-righteous, judgmental. A Christian who's thoughtful, who doesn't take themselves too seriously, who just likes being with people, they had no category for that. My goal in going there wasn't to try to answer all their apologetic questions as if they'd magically come to Christ. It was to plant seeds, break down their expectations of what they thought a Christian was like, so maybe they'd consider the gospel in a fresh way. I'll never forget a lady sitting in the front, about where you are, Steve. At the very end, when I said, I asked them a question. I said, can I ask you guys some questions? They said, sure. And I could have asked them some of the questions you asked, like, how do you get a universe from nothing? That's a really good question. That's a great question. How do you get something from nothing? Where does the universe come from? I could have asked him, how do you get morality without God? That's a great question. Your question in the back, how do you get the information in a cell? Where does this come from? There are no naturalistic answers for these questions. There's not. And those are great positive evidences pointing towards God. I could have asked him those questions. Instead, what I did is I said, can you tell me what bad impressions do Christians leave? And a lady sitting right in front, she goes, listen. I said, what do you mean? She said, my Christian friends, they love to preach at me. They love to tell me when I'm wrong. Occasionally tell me if I don't hold their beliefs, I'm going to hell, but they don't want to listen to my beliefs. Why should I listen to them when they don't listen to me? I'll never forget it. Then a fellow in the back, his son was at Biola at the time. So he said he used to be a Christian. His son is still a Christian. He's not, and he has this website like trying to debunk Christianity. He goes, stop the atheist jokes. I thought, dang it, I've got some good ones. Like, actually, the word he used, he said, stop slandering atheists. Now, that's a pretty strong charge, right? I said, slander? Like, that's a serious, what do you mean? He goes, look, I'm an atheist. I will go sit in the back of church now and then and just observe. People don't know who I am or why I'm there. He goes, I go just to watch. Now, if you think about it, if you're not a Christian, church actually really is a very interesting sociological phenomena. In church the other day, we had a song with no context singing about the blood. Now, if you don't understand theology, that's really weird, right? Why do you hold hands? Why is your head down? Anyways, he goes and he just observes. He goes, every time I go, there's some cheap shot or some insult against atheists or some other non-Christian group. And I'm sitting there like nudging my wife like, whatever, this guy's over the top. We're not that bad. I'm telling you, within a week or two, I'm sitting in church. The pastor tells a joke at the expense of atheists. And my wife squeezed my knee. She's like, see, that guy was right. We don't even realize how much we did this. And it's like God opened up my eyes to be more sensitive to the way we communicate, the stories we tell, the jokes we laugh at, prevents people from even hearing what we believe is true. So as we start off this conference, you have a chance to go learn about Mormonism. You have a chance to go learn about whether there's truth or not, reliability of the Bible, Islam. These are important, big issues of our day. Good for you for taking out a Saturday to wrestle with these ideas. But ask yourself some questions first. Am I here to fill up my notebook to get answers, to win arguments? If so, when this session is done, just leave, because you'll probably do more harm than you will good. But if you're here because you want to build up your own faith, if you're here because you want to understand first, and then in a loving relationship, be able to guide people to answers, you're in exactly the right place. Now, we have just a few minutes before break. Usually I keep talking, but I'm going to stop. Are there any questions that either tripped you up or questions for me you want me to talk about before we go to the break? Now's your chance. Yes. I'll repeat it, but say it as fast as you can. Did I get the whole scenario from my friend? Not all the answers from my friend, but the story. He grew up in a Christian church about 15, 16, had an atheist ask him some questions, didn't have answers, led to him completely abandoning his faith. He is still an atheist. Here's what's interesting. We've had a lot of conversations, and he is an atheist, but I don't think when it's all said and done, his reasons are purely intellectual. I think he, last time I, is this being recorded? Is this being recorded? Okay. So all I'll say is it's more than purely intellectual for him. And let me take a step back. When it comes to belief, there's a lot of reasons students can have doubts. Intellectual is one reason. But I found if students are on a college campus and they're experiencing more pressure morally, gosh, there's this girl who wants to sleep with me, I want to go to a party, then the arguments against God's existence seem to be much more compelling than they were before. Mm-hmm. It's true. People have emotional doubt, moral doubt, relational doubt. Some of it is intellectual. But nobody goes, yeah, I want to sleep with my girlfriend, so here's my argument. Actually, I did have a guy tell me that. It's more sophisticated to couch it as intellectual questions. I'm not saying intellectual questions aren't genuine. I wouldn't be here if they weren't. But there's often a lot more behind it, and that is true in his case.
So I thought there were some excellent points made in regards to debunking evolution and talking about the impossibility of evolution when you break it down to its, you know, its smallest parts. My question to you would be is that I've spent a lot of time researching what people believe, well, actually, most people don't even know what they believe when it comes to evolution. They just know it's taught in schools, and therefore it must be true. My point being is that I find that science seems to be one of the biggest things that keeps people away from God because they've kind of replaced God with their with science as religion. But I also find that when I try and debate them on that, they get very hostile. Mm. Even when I try and talk as calmly as I am now and try and be as loving as possible, I almost find that when I start breaking down what they think they know about evolution and talking to them in the they get angry, and then it becomes a challenge to try and talk about anything else. So I've almost avoided the subject of science and evolution with people, even though that's their biggest stumbling block to believing in God, or at least that's what I perceive. So, I mean, what are your thoughts? Is it good to delve into trying to talk about science with people to try and debunk why they are using that as a roadblock to God?
So, in general, I would say I think the approach of Jesus is wise, that he didn't just have one strategy that he applied to everybody. The woman at the well he talked to differently than he did the rich young ruler. And by the way, he also let the rich young ruler just walk away because he knew he wasn't open. We can't force anybody to believe. You can't argue someone in the kingdom. You can't love somebody into the kingdom if their heart is not open. So I think there needs to be some wisdom, prayerful wisdom, that comes with the guiding of the Holy Spirit and you know, just experience about, do I talk with science to this person? Do I talk not about science? Because people are wired differently and they have different objections. So I don't blanket statement things to people. In general, I mean, you have a ministry here, Reasons to Believe, and they see a lot of people coming to faith through science. A lot of people come to faith through science. Now, if our expectation is, if I use science and I have the right argument, 90% of people are going to believe, you will be disappointed 88% of the time. But if the goal is to speak truth lovingly, to speak it clearly, to be patient, then I do see God using science in people's lives. Now, sometimes I'll do this. Sometimes because people get so heated about evolution in particular, I'll say, look, for the sake of conversation, you can have evolution. What if Darwin was right, that one species changes into another? He didn't explain the origin of life. He didn't explain fine-tuning. Didn't explain the origin of the universe. Didn't explain consciousness. Didn't explain morality. Didn't explain the existence of objective beauty. In fact, Darwin didn't explain almost anything that's really interesting. Let's come back to evolution. Let's ask the bigger questions first that are less heated. Something from nothing, fine-tuning, origin of life. That's one tactic I'll take. For some people, if they're so hostile, I'll just say, all right, let's talk about morality. I actually think if I have one argument to talk with somebody, I'm going to use the argument of morality because it's personal. That's often where I go. So don't discount all of science. When you look at the book You Lost Me by David Kinman, of the top six reasons that people leave their faith, the supposed contradiction between faith and science is one of them. It's a big issue, which says we have to help kids younger think through this stuff. So when those challenges come, they're prepared. So we certainly have to do a better job with that. But I'm going to try to tailor to where that person is. And some question I'll ask is I'll say, look, what would you accept as compelling evidence? What would you find to believe in God? What would it take for you? And if I answered this, would you be one step closer to believing in God? And you'd be amazed at the answers people will give. Sometimes the answer is, you know what? No, if you answered this, it wouldn't help. I'd say, good. Then now we know what doesn't really matter. Let's talk about what does. Those are a few ways I try to navigate in some of those conversations. That's a great question, yeah.
Hi, Sean. My name is Keith. I think there's three major obstacles that we face when we're trying to do this. One is people that are closed-minded.
Sure.
No matter what we say, they're just going to
sure.
reject it. I think the other is, and we experienced it with you, is that when we deal with someone who's more knowledgeable on the subject than we are, and as knowledgeable as so many of these people were much more than I, PhD, all the study, been doing this for years, we're going to lose 9 times out of 10 because,
okay.
And I think the third thing which was expressed was the emotion that's attached, and even though atheists and others can be very emotional, I think we could sense that there was some emotion coming from us asking questions,
sure.
too.
I felt it, just for the record.
And frustration, which then becomes counterproductive, and so I appreciate this last comment that you made about finding the right approach that's specific and loving rather than trying to win.
So this is really important. The point of this is not you have to go out and get a PhD before you can have a conversation with people. That is not the point of this session, right? I mean, even for myself, in conversations, I'm like, what if they ask me something I don't know? And I've been doing this for years, have 2 masters and a PhD, and I'll meet people smarter in a field than me. That's not the point. You're here today, you pick up a handful of books, you're already more equipped than most people that are out there. And the point is also not to just to get into arguments with people. That's not the point. That is not the goal. I did this to kind of surface within yourself, all right, am I ready? How do I approach people? How do I treat people? That's where we need to start. But you don't need to get a PhD. Now, Jesus said, love God with your heart, your soul, and your mind. So as we start to learn stuff, it gives us confidence. And I've actually found the reason I think people tend to get defensive and angry when I do this is because we don't know what we believe. You think about that? We're not threatened when somebody challenges us on something when we know the answer. When someone challenges us and we don't know it and we feel like we should, what happens? It's natural human nature to get defensive and to get angry. That's why if we want to be able to talk calmly and lovingly and patiently with people, we need to learn a little bit about what we believe and why. That's why an event like today is so, so important. So thank you for bringing that up. Does someone else have the mic? We are running short on time. You got to be like fast, lady.
Okay, really quick. Putting your glasses back on,
uh-oh.
Can you share with me how you obtain peace when you have done something wrongful and hurtful to someone else or chosen a bad path for yourself?
So I'm not going to put my glasses on, but I'll tell you how my atheist friends might respond. They might say, I ask for forgiveness. I believe in forgiveness. I believe we do things that are wrong. I don't need God. I just go to the person, and I get peace about it. I think that's what they might say. We've been wired by evolution that when we do things wrong, for the social group to have cohesiveness and peace, we experience that through forgiveness. So I'd probably give some kind of evolutionary account for how that operates. This is just human behavior. Or my friends might say, look, whether I have peace or not doesn't mean that Christianity is true. I mean, Christianity is not true or false. Atheism is not true or false because it's comfortable and gives us peace. It's true or false because of the evidence. That's maybe what they would say. But that's a good question. That's a fair personal question. All right. So back there, my books are discounted like ridiculous discounts. Almost down to cost. I'm serious. The Is God Is Human Invention is back there. It's normally $17. It's $10 just for today. Actually, tomorrow at church, I'll probably do it too. I cannot lie since we're in a church. Not that I normally lie. Isn't that funny when you qualify things? Just take that out of the record. $10, so it's virtually cost that's back there if that book is helpful to you. Classic book my dad wrote, I'll talk about later, Trying to Disprove Christianity, How We Know the Bible's True, Jesus Rose from the Grave, and Jesus is God in Human Flesh, a book more than a carpenter. I talked to a friend who just became a Christian recently. He goes, I just keep this in my backpack all the time. It, like, gives me comfort, which is really interesting. You'd never told me that before. So that's back there discounted. And then something that I had a chance to put together, I don't know where Steve went. He helped me with this. And I think maybe, Jeff, you helped me with this too, I believe. It's an apologetic study Bible for students. And essentially, we got the top 120 questions students ask about God, about the Bible, other religions. There's all these other features in there, but in one page, and then with study notes at the bottom, just give answers to these. I had a skeptic ask me a question. I kid you not, had I studied Bible, I opened up, I'm like, oh, actually, here's an answer. It was kind of cool. So it has one of my favorite questions in it, which is, if God made everything, why is it wrong to smoke pot? That's a great question. How do you answer that? You want an answer, right? You're going to have to pick up a copy. Where's Bo? I let you out of here 2 or 3 minutes early to get us to the breaks at 10:40. So those are out there. If it's helpful, enjoy your day. Take it for all it's worth.